everyone, and welcome to Film Strips, the podcast that's in search of a joke to insert here. I'm Dave Babbitt.
And I'm Andrew Kanigiser. And Dave, what is our show all about?
Why, this is indeed Film Strips, the podcast in which each and every episode we take a look at a film, dissect it, look at the nuances, the production history, the subtext, the paratext, the metatext, all the other text you can think of. We will spoil the living heck out of the film under discussion over the course of it, so please take that as your warning for the episode. The important thing is that each and every film under discussion, however, must somehow connect back to the film we discussed on the preceding episode. And Andrew, what were we taking a look at last time in this little program of ours?
Last time, we were looking at Gaudi.
Yes, we were looking at Gaudi.
We had a little bit of a break, peek behind the curtain, but we're coming back refreshed and revitalized. And from the bizarre work that was 2018's Gaudi, we have decided to follow actress Kelly Preston to a film that maybe hits the level of gritty darkness that Gaudi could only dream of. We're going back to 1986, the year I was born, for director John Frankenheimer, one of his maybe lesser known works. We're looking at 52 Pickup, featuring a cast including Roy Scheider making his third appearance, and Margaret Vanity, Kelly Preston, John Glover, Robert Trevor, and last but certainly not least, Clarence Williams III. So, spoiler alert, everybody. Dave said we will absolutely ruin the plot of the film, but as an additional update, this is a very grim and ugly movie, so we may not get as many terrible puns out of it, or at least all of our jokes about the film will be followed by us cringing as we recognize the implications.
Yeah, though the positive side of things, at least we got one unique form of cadence in this film that's probably going to bring us some joy over the course of it. So it's not all bad things.
Yeah, and I guess maybe the more interesting point to start with, I guess, is that it is also featuring a script written by the man who also wrote the source novel for it, one Elmore Leonard. Dave, how are you with your contemporary crime and criminality novels?
Well, I'll put it to you this way. I think like many people who were growing up during the 90s, boy, did I have an Elmore Leonard phase. And he's definitely well worth exploring, to say the least.
Well, exactly. And, I mean, there are people at home listening to our show that have never heard of 52 Pickup or Elmore Leonard, and certainly weren't born in the year 1986. So what better time to turn to Dave, who's going to do what he does best, and give us the rundown.
52 Pickup is director John Frankenheimer's 1986 adaptation of the crime novel by Elmore Leonard. Roy Scheider stars as Harry Mitchell, a wealthy businessman whose life is thrown into chaos when he is blackmailed by three pornographers who have evidence of an affair he's been having. When Harry refuses to pay, the situation quickly escalates, putting both Harry and his wife in danger. Released to mediocre reviews and poor box office receipts, 52 Pickup remains a lesser regarded film in Frankenheimer's filmography. Coming up after Film Strips, Scott Adkins stars in the pilot episode of Phantom Thread, the series.
Like you, Dave, I grew up in a small town where there wasn't much to do, so I was an avid reader of all things pulp. And I mean, Elmore Leonard, it certainly was a distinctive enough name that I heard people saying it, so I think when I was 13, I found a copy of Get Shorty in the Public Library and read that. I really dug it for a while. Leonard, though, I mean, as a figure, he's born in 1925, dies in 2013. Apparently, he started writing westerns, much like Joseph Cotten in The Third Man. But he sort of turns in the late 1960s. I think it's The Big Bounce in 1969, which is his first crime novel. And he pretty much writes in that vein, notably, for the rest of his career.
Well, precisely, yeah. And I think it's one of those things where it's hard to sort of it's hard not to really want to emphasize how significant Elmore Leonard was as a figure during our, you know, adolescence, I guess. Because the thing about Elmore Leonard is, yeah, basically, he had been around, sort of strikes at his sort of niche in the crime market throughout the 60s and 70s. and then really sort of hits his stride as a best-selling author in the late 1980s. By that point. And this ultimately leads, yes, to the big explosion of Elmore Leonard adaptations in the 90s. But yeah, we have this big trifecta that sort of hits in the mid to late 90s in terms of film adaptations of Leonard's work. Starting with Get Shorty in 1995, the very beloved, but not exactly a major hit for Quentin Tarantino in 97, Jackie Brown, based off the novel, I believe it is Sucker Punch? Or
Rum Punch. Sucker Punch is a terrible movie, though. On the subject of Zack Snyder, I mean, at least people are talking about Justice League for once. I mean, they certainly didn't 2 years ago, but go on.
Yes, and then, of course, there is Steven Soderbergh's adaptation of Out of Sight, which was also a big, huge hit at that time. Although, I am personally going to go to bat for one of the novels I read in high school, because I actually did... not only did I do a novel study on Be Cool, as my sort of independent novel study of choice.
Which itself was made into a film in 2005, I think, that basically received the antithetical response that Get Shorty did.
Exactly. But there was also Maximum Bob, which was made into a short-lived but not bad television show starring Beau Bridges in the late 90s as well. So, yeah, I will go to bat for that novel based on my 20-plus-year-old memories at this point.
Yeah, Dave Babbitt, the great thing about you is that you remember all the things that the world and even culture itself forgets.
Yeah, but the big thing here is that ultimately, yeah, Leonard became really famous as a pulp writer, but I think the big thing as his sort of crime fiction goes is he had a very unique sense of style, and a lot of that style was built around this idea of sort of quippy, humorous, darkly funny crime stories in some ways.
Yeah, like a very naturalistic sense of dialogue instead of necessarily like the Dashiell Hammett, almost stage-like dialogue that you see in sort of classic noir, like Leonard's contribution and sort of the thing that unites his works, maybe more so than a necessary theme or a particular like moral universe. It's the fact that like there is a very naturalistic tone to the dialogue. He is known to write conversationally and like dialectically more than necessarily grammatically. But it's like Robert Frost. It's sort of like speaking the music and the poetry and natural rhythms of real life speech.
Well, exactly. And that was the thing. I mean, Leonard's voice, it was so distinctive as a writer that it was unmistakable when you were reading his work.
Yeah, it's the same way with David Mamet. I mean, we always dunk on him whenever we get the chance. But there is a distinctly like Leonardian tone. One of the things I remember from the novel Be Cool is when he's meeting with the agent that's talking about his previous film, and the guy says something to the effect of like, "Oh, Chili, that movie, oh man, it was great. It was wonderful. And most of all, it was good."
Yes.
And like, that's just the sort of like, that to me is like one of the indicative types of things you would get in a Leonard novel. But it's also interesting because we were talking about how, maybe unlike a Stephen King or something, his work is kind of broader than you think. Like, not a lot of people, I think, innately realize Jackie Brown is an adaptation. The same way I didn't even realize the TV series Justified is an adaptation, or yet another bizarre thing that you remember that no one else does. And what is that?
Yes, there was the little novel called Pronto, which was later adapted in the late 90s into a made-for-TV movie starring Peter Falk and James LaGrosse. So, Exactly. So we'll probably have to cover that at some point, if only just to say we did it. But I mean, that's but you're quite right. I mean, Leonard's work is more diverse, and I think his influence is sort of harder to parse out. And the thing is that I think part of what defines him as a writer, though, is that he is also somebody who came out, you know, he's a writer based out of Michigan, which puts him distinctly in a different milieu compared to sort of like the New York crime writers or the LA crime writers.
Yeah, James Ellroy, for instance, yeah. like his novels are all set in LA or the LA region, you know, and that is so much a character of his books. Yeah, whereas Leonard, it is distinct to get like pretty much the northern border of crime that isn't New York.
Well, exactly. And I think it's also to the point that in many ways, when he does venture into what would be quote unquote more familiar territory, such as Get Shorty, unmistakably a film set in LA for the most part, but it's very much that outsider perspective on LA.
Exactly. It's a stranger in a strange land. Can you believe what the movie industry is like? It's bananas.
Well, and Elmore Leonard definitely knew what the movie industry was like because he actually wrote quite a bit for cinema and television as well.
Yeah, he's not like a Faulkner or a Barton Fink, rather than a cautionary parable. He's someone that actively participates in the process and has seen quite a bit of success doing it.
Well, yeah, I mean, he worked on the script for the original Mr. Majestic, it's The Mechanic that got remade with Jason Statham. Worked on the screenplay for Cat Chaser, the Abel Ferrara film starring Peter Weller.
I have no idea what that is. Something called High Noon Part 2, The Return of Will Kane.
A made-for-TV movie, yes, because we were all desperately seeking the sequel to High Noon over 20 years later and starring nobody from the original movie.
Yeah, actually, over the weekend, I visited our mutual friend of the show, Drew Jeffries. Hello, if you are listening to this. And we got on the subject of Easy Rider. Did the proposed sequel to Easy Rider ever get made?
Oh, yeah, there is an Easy Rider 2 made in, like, the mid-2000s.
Yes, okay, because I remember reading about that, and he had no idea what I was talking about. And he was full of questions, as was I, when I first read about it in Movie Maker magazine. It was like, how on earth can they do that? They're both dead. And I'm like, well, as the director of this proposed film said, you actually don't see Peter Fonda die.
Well, I would say you can see the clips of it and trailers and that online. I haven't watched it all in full, and based on what I'm seeing, I'm not planning to watch it in full either.
I'm like, that's a film you don't need to see to have an accurate critical assessment. So I guess that takes us, though, to 52 Pickup, because if we want to think of it sort of within the Leonardverse, and indeed some of the characters do cross over novel to novel, from what I gather, 52 Pickup is a fairly standalone one, and it is also distinctly of a different tone than those 1990s films, because I think what sort of unites them is like that snappiness of the dialogue combined with a very flashy or sort of stylized aesthetic, which isn't to say that 52 Pickup, when it hits the screen with a script by Leonard and John Stepling and directed by John Frankenheimer, like, it has that snappy dialogue, but it is absolutely awash in, like, a deliberately ugly aesthetic.
Well, yes, and I think there's two things to sort of speak to this, because the thing about 52 Pickup as a novel, I have not read it, but in terms of the timeline, it's released in 1974. So this is not that long after Leonard has made his shift into predominantly writing crime fiction at this point. So you could probably look at this where, you know, a lot of the latter stuff gets a little bit quirkier and weirder in some ways. This might be him more straight-laced. I guess it might be the best way to put it.
Well, I guess it's like Steven Spielberg making a film now versus when he was making Duel, right? I mean, now there's a very distinct sense within culture at large of what a Spielberg film is. That simply wasn't the case early on.
Well, exactly. On the other hand, I mean, there are two things. Before we even get to John Frankenheimer, who we'll definitely have to discuss, because there's an auteur in his own right, it's worth noting that the production history for this novel and its adaptations is a little bit weirder than most.
Yeah, because this isn't actually the first time that the novel 52 Pickup has been adapted.
Yes, because the rights to this novel were picked up by a little group called the Canon Group, run by...
Oh, Canon. I can't believe we haven't had a deep dive on Canon. We need to one day, and I'm sure we will. We don't have time to do that here, but Canon Group, I think, the best way I think of it is it seems like at any point it was about to be revealed as an international pyramid scheme of fraud, but it never did because they kept making movies.
Up until, yeah, the very late 80s. But before that happened, yeah, it was run by Yoram Globus and Menahem Golan. And they actually had... Canon is probably most infamous for turning out a lot of what we would consider sort of lower-end sleazy films, such as the Death Wish sequels probably being the most notorious ones, and a lot of Charles Bronson's output of the 1980s. Yeah.
As well as Superman 4, The Quest for Peace. But yeah, like, they're... It's sort of like Abel Ferrara, the production company, where everything is marketed as being, like, that hard-nosed grime, but yet marketed with, like, very much appealing to people through, like, the violence and the sexuality. The thing is, Canon, like, their films weren't totally exploitation, the same way that films like I Spit on Your Grave are, but they're never far removed from it. And even as good as 52 Pickup is, tipping my hand a little early, I'm not going to pretend that it's never wholly removed from that sense of exploitation either.
Well, this is the thing, because the thing that I remember about Canon Group is, yeah, they were like basically a higher end exploitation fair where, you know, they would produce some really super cheesy stuff.
They kind of feel like Shaw Brothers from a different hemisphere.
Sort of, but with the case of it typically being a little bit sleazier and definitely paying... In many instances, people who were up and coming or who were definitely on their way down in terms of their careers, typically. However, having said that, there are two other strands we need to acknowledge here. One is that occasionally, Canon would actually go out of their way and back films by noted auteurs once in a blue moon and make something with more artistic significance, such as a little film called Runaway Train, which me and James covered back on Cinema Chase years ago for that show. It was, that one's a heck of a film, to say the least. But they also occasionally were known for their absolutely earnest, gobsmackingly weird personal projects of the producers that, again, sort of...
All right, give me some names on this one.
Well, one, probably the most infamous one is The Apple, their quasi-religious movie set about the return of Christ, but set within the music industry.
I have no idea what this movie is. I'm looking it up right now. Keep talking.
Point being is that, you know, they, you know... The Golden Globus, they could be very passionate filmmakers, and when they got behind something, sometimes things struck their fancy that they thought were important when dealing with. And one of the things here is, I believe both originate in the Israel film industry.
Menachem Golan, I think it's safe to assume.
Yes.
For those of you at home, The Apple, also called Star Rock, is a 1980 sci-fi musical comedy, if I may read from Google.
Yes.
Young singers Alfie, George Gilmore, and Baby, Catherine Mary Stewart, have big musical dreams when they leave Canada to compete in the World Vision Song Festival. Though the festival's organizer, Mr. Boogalow, Vladek Shyball, rigs the contest for others to win, he shows an interest in Alfie and Bebe, offering to sign them. But then Bebe is taken in by the evil wild world of rock and roll, and Alfie is determined to save her, even though Boogalow says that he owns both her and her soul. Budget $10 million US.
Yeah. Just look up the trailer, folks. You're going to have a
4.3 out of 10 on IMDb and a respectable even 20% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Beyond that little passion project for them, they also happened to make a weird little film in 1984 called The Ambassador. Now, allow me to explain this, because The Ambassador is a film about the following. It is basically about a U.S. ambassador in Israel trying to resolve the Israeli and Palestinian conflict by basically engaging in undercover negotiations between the more,
the militant wing.
Yeah.
Like the PLO.
Yeah, exactly. Basically trying, yes, to bridge the peace by finding the more moderate individuals between them and bring it together. Except, you know, during this time, his wife has an affair with a member of the PLO, which is caught on film by a Mossad agent, which is then being used to blackmail the ambassador to give up his efforts to basically try and find peace in the Middle East in our times.
I mean, like, that is insane to me, because having seen this film, I'm like, okay, well, like, it's pretty much a pulp crime narrative. It can work in any context. So of all the possible locations and possible contexts you could situate this in, you chose the backdrop of the Israel and Palestine conflict in 1984.
And yeah, that's the thing. This is based off Elmore Leonard's 52 Pickup, a crime story set in Detroit that has nothing to do with an ambassador or the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
Yeah, it's... I'm amazed. It's everything that The Omen should have been.
The point being that this film was, needless to say, not a hit, critically or financially, and Elmore Leonard wasn't too fond of it either. However, during this time, John Frankenheimer comes across the book 52 Pickup and apparently really wants to adapt it. When it's pointed...
Yes, beloved director of Reindeer Game, John Frankenheimer.
Yes, let's back up and maybe explain Frankenheimer a little bit more, because yes, Reindeer Games might be the thing. You might remember that we talked about him briefly when we discussed Dominion, prequel to The Exorcist, because before Paul Schrader was on there, John Frankenheimer was going to direct that film, and then he got sick, had to back out, and then shortly thereafter died. Long before yes. any of that happened, however.
It's a better film when you realize the director was actively dying while making it, and not in the dignified Nicholas Rogue way. But yeah, like, he directed The Manchurian Candidate in 1962, which is regarded by many as, like, one of the best American films ever made.
Yeah.
7 Days in May, Birdman of Alcatraz, Seconds, French Connection 2, and a film that I know you and James both really enjoy, Ronin, in 1998.
Written by David Mamet, because it all comes full circle. But yes, I mean, the thing about for John Frankenheimer is he was a filmmaker who was very known for taking a lot of hard-edged subject matter for his work. And by all accounts, he was a very macho filmmaker and very much a sort of dictator on set. He produced unquestionably a bucket load of classics. Again, most people would kill to have at least one of his major films on their resume, let alone having The Manchurian Candidate, Ronin, The Birdman of Alcatraz, on
the Island of Dr. Moreau.
Well, I was going to say, Frankenheimer also had instances which didn't go well. Now, granted, the Monroe situation was not created by him, but he sure as hell contributed to it, and there's a reason why a lot of the people basically say they hated working with him on that film. Because, yeah, John Frankenheimer was a very hard man with very little patience for anybody. And by all accounts, he suffered no fools or even, you know, much in the way of basically getting along with anyone. He's also notoriously known as basically being possibly the biological father of Michael Bay, something which has never been proven and which he apparently denied for up until his death.
Wait, what? Okay, never mind. I don't care.
Yeah.
But the other thing is, as difficult as he is known to be to work with, he is also pretty much up until the time of his death, a fairly prolific filmmaker. And I mean, even looking it over, prior to 52 Pickup, he makes The Challenge in 82, and then The Holcroft Covenant in 1985, and then a year later, he makes 52 Pickup. So, I mean, as difficult as he is to work with, I think there's also a sense in his films, because, how shall I put it, it's not that they are not aestheticized, or that there's no craft to the cinematography, or that there isn't anything technically impressive about them, but rather he's able to do that in a way that fits with, like, why the Hollywood Renaissance was successful, right? Because it's able to do stylish things in kind of that European, I guess, low-budget kind of way. Like, The French Connection, too, certainly has its elements of style, but you don't need enormous sets. It's shot on location, you know. You don't need much wardrobe, because everyone's either a cop or a pimp, right?
Well, absolutely. And I think in the case of Frankenheimer, it's just, again, he's a meticulous filmmaker. Like, when you're watching his films, the man is a craftsman above and beyond anything else. He knows what he wants, he's gonna get it, and he's gonna put it on screen. Whether or not it fully works is up for debate, But you don't kind of mess, with John Frankenheimer for the most part. Unless your name's Marlon Brando, but that's neither here nor there. Hence, we get ice buckets on people's heads in scenes. Anyways, I did watch The Island of Dr. Monroe as well in preparation for this episode. I'm not going to lie. So that's sticking out quite a bit here as well.
Okay, well, I didn't, so you can suffer in silence.
Fair enough. The point is though, that Frankenheimer is attracted to this project, and basically, by all accounts, he approached the Cannon Group saying, I want to make this into a film. And rather than shoot him down and say, we just did it, since they really didn't, despite what the credits may say otherwise, they basically decide that, sure, we will make this. Because, hey, we're getting John Frankenheimer to work on a Cannon movie, okay?
Well, yeah. So even though, like, A-list studios would be like, Frankenheimer, you haven't really had a film that's done well since Prophecy, and even that's debatable. So, maybe cool it with the big ideas, whereas an outfit like Cannon's like, yeah, a former A-lister wants to work with us. So, I mean, the good fortune of Frankenheimer is like, Cannon is always there to support you, because they see the real craftsman in you, especially if they can afford it.
Yes, not to say that they didn't necessarily push for some of the more salacious elements we will see in the film, but because this is an Elmore Leonard novel, at least it lends itself to it as you get into it. But, well, we'll get there. So yeah, the basic thing is Frankenheimer quickly puts together his cast and crew, which, as we noted here, includes Roy Scheider, yes, who, again, we first covered back when we did All That Jazz.
Yes, who looked like he was dying then, and here he is 8 years older.
Yeah.
We also saw him in David Cronenberg's Naked Lunch.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So, I mean, again, 1980s, Roy Scheider is still a respected actor. I don't know whether you can quite say that he's a star in the same way as you would expect from, say, others, like, say, Richard Dreyfuss in the late 80s, I think would still be a bigger star than Roy Scheider was at that time. Beside him, we get Anne Margaret, a very respected actor, but I'm trying to think, Andrew, was there ever really a point where Anne Margaret was a star that you can think of?
Bye Bye Birdie?
Maybe, but in addition to Anne Margaret, we also have John Glover, Robert Tribor, and Clarence Williams III as our trio of villains, and we'll get more to them, trust me, it's fun. But the key thing to keep in mind here is that basically as the film opens, we see the morning life of Harry and Barbara Mitchell. As Harry's working on his car, getting ready for the day, Barbara seems to be looking in on him, little concerned about something. We're not quite sure what at this point. But he takes off, he heads for his business, which is basically manufacturing what I guess is space shuttle shielding for the rockets, which somehow this process will involve explosives, but we'll get there fairly soon. Barbara, meanwhile, goes into her job, where she is offered the position to basically run for city council alongside the district attorney, an offer she's very interested in taking up. And everything seems to be going pretty well, except Harry decides to make a stop along the way home.
So, and with that scene, he enters, calls out the name of his mistress that we haven't met quite yet, Sini, which is not a name. And as he walks into the bedroom, all of a sudden he's greeted by two masked men, while a third, in a great shot, draws a gun and points it to the back of his head. This is all the first 5 minutes of the film,
yep.
And then we see what the film is really going to be about.
Yes, because at gunpoint, basically, Harry is forced to watch footage of him with his mistress as they're going out on vacation together, and footage of a uncomfortably nude Roy Scheider with a Cindy, played here by Kelly Preston, who is who's way, way younger than him here.
Yes. Diegetically, she's 22 years old. A real winter spring romance.
Yeah, but the big thing here is that basically as they're going through, we have one person talking throughout this, and we'll eventually realize that this is the character of Alan Ramey, played by John Glover. And okay, let's start talking about a couple things. Number one, John Glover is amazing in this movie. I'm just going to flat out say it right off the bat here. But
that rare energy that you can get in a villain. I think it's sort of on the same tier as Gary Oldman in The Professional.
Yeah, but with the thing with Glover is, like, I mean, number one, he is incapable of giving a bad performance. I don't think I've ever seen him turn in bad work. But
he's reliable.
Oh, yeah. But here, he has got this cadence that almost feels like it should be out of the film Fargo, in terms of how he's speaking. And
well, yeah, because one and the same time, he's very sophisticated, but, like, in the sense of, like, purposely speaking in a way to come off as a very shrewd person, but also something very uncomfortably pally about it. And as we see, like, throughout the film, his common term of endearment for people is sport.
Yeah, and he is just, like, I mean, the dialogue he is spitting off is vulgar and objectifying.
Well, yeah, because
everyone.
He's effectively narrating the film, and as we soon discover, he has an interest in filmmaking. But what this scene also does, because with a gun to his head, all Harry can do is just watch in silence as these guys berate him, let him know that he's been honey trapped, and then proceed to blackmail him. But what's effective about it is that Alan tells us everything we need to know about Harry's background, that he's been married for 23 years, that his wife is successful in politics, the size and scope of his company, the fact that he used to work for NASA and he was in the Air Force, and it brings us all up to speed. And normally that would be just a redundant exposition dump. Like, why would they have to explain it? But the script actually does simply solve that problem with a simple line, because as blackmailers, he summarizes by saying, now you know what we know about you, so you can be absolutely clear where we're going with this. And they effectively say that the bizarrely specific sum of $105,000 they want delivered to him, or the tape will get distributed.
So yeah, so to sort of bring us back at this point, I mean, one of the things that this scene pretty clearly establishes right off the bat is that when it comes to our protagonist of Harry, he is a screw up, unquestionably here. And as we'll go on throughout the rest of the film to figure, one of the things that Frankenheimer and company really underscores that is the fact that we're not meant to view Harry as a sympathetic figure necessarily.
Well, yeah. And I think it helps because in the scene, it also establishes that, you know, Harry is basically just being confronted with objective facts, but we can see that he does not look highly upon his own actions as well.
Well, exactly. And I think one of the things, to come back to Roy Scheider, it's kind of, it's amazing that, you know, both times where he's been in a lead role in a film so far that we've dealt with him, basically build around the fact that he is a older than middle age and somehow basically sleeping with women half his age or less, as it were, which, again, is kind of an odd facet for an actor's screen persona. But it's the thing that, again, Roy Scheider plays that sort of hollow, weak-willed individual extremely well.
Yeah, like the word for Harry in this scene is defeated, or maybe he's resigned, because he doesn't protest, right? He doesn't even speak, really, in any material sense. Like, we don't get the outburst, we don't get, like, the aborted action sequence or anything like that. He just sits there and he listens, and obviously there's a gun to his head, but you get the sense that he wouldn't protest anyway. There's just this, he can convey in a look, there's nothing I can do.
Yes, but there are two key scenes that follow up from this that are kind of important, because Harry doesn't act here, but number one, he goes home, has a discussion with his wife, and Andrew, what little fact is he now confronted upon from her at this point?
Well, wait, doesn't the dinner for the DA happen first?
No, this happens first, where she reveals that she is going to get met, or she is going
or
to be, she's been
vetted.
Offered. Yeah, she's being vetted, and that she's been offered that, and she asks Harry, it's like, well, what do you think? Should I run? And of course, his sort of view, as hollow as it sounds, like, well, yeah, I mean, honestly, this is your big chance, is your big moment. Which then leads us to a scene where Harry is discussing with his nebulously defined best friend slash...
He's like his fixer. Like, I think they say he's his lawyer, but like, it's a very close relationship.
Yeah, which leads us to this interestingly shot scene where apparently Harry and his crew are out in the middle of an LA desert, setting up this weird explosive procedure or process, which apparently helps make shuttlecraft alloys, I guess. It's,
There's blasting. I'm not a demolitions expert. Clearly it's working out okay for Harry.
But the important thing is that he starts asking for advice, where it's like, look, you know, I owe it, and again, it's interesting how he phrases it in the sense that it's like, look, I owe it to my wife. She stood by me while I built this company up.
Well, yeah, and that's an interesting intervention because I think most films would probably go the route of Harry telling more and more lies to try and, like, keep this quiet and keep it under control, whereas here, we see he's pretty genuine, and as he says, like, after being married for 23 years, like, this is something she wants for her, and he wants to be able to give that to her.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, it's very, as he's asking his lawyer slash friend for advice, his basic point is like, look, you can't pay the money to them, because if you pay the money to them, you know, you're going to be on the hook for it forever.
Like seagulls at the beach.
Yeah, so with the nice big explosion that we get to witness with them behind sort of a safety protective barrier set up then, we then cut, though, to a party at a, you know, house in the hills, I guess would be the best way to put it, and this...
Yeah, maybe even the house from Paul Schrader's The Hills. It is very much a valley house.
Yeah, and as we're going through this party, we basically are being reintroduced to a couple things. First of all, I guess the best way to describe the scene of this type of party is that it's full of a lot of people who are engaged in acts of, let's just say debauchery.
The scene is also staffed with members of the California adult film scene, including the now indicted Ron Jeremy.
May he rest in jail. But putting that aside, yeah, so this basically leads us to the point that, yeah, we are reintroduced to our blackmailers outside of their masks here, and we get a quick look at the three of them. So our first one probably worth noting here is Bobby Shaye, the Clarence Williams III character here, who, again, I love his performance throughout the scene, where he is either very meditative and distracted, or possibly just stoned out of his mind right now.
Yeah, it's like Lee Marvin in Point Blank. It's just, by being a silent presence in the scene, he adds so much to it. Because we're introduced to Bobby as the camera, like, keeps panning through, and we see hedonism on display, and then we get Clarence Williams III, who notably is one of the only prominent black faces in the cast.
Yeah.
We see him wearing almost like quasi-panther garb, dressed all in black leather, like just sitting in the foreground of the scene, looking off screen and saying nothing.
Yeah, and the person who is basically he's dealing with while this party's going on, because he's effectively sitting on a kitchen counter, just mellowed out, is Leo Franks, played by Robert Tribor, who is just chatting him up like nonstop about, oh, how this is great, this is going, how we're gonna have the money very soon.
He's very much the gadfly of the group. You know, overly talkative. He's the glad hander, ambiguous sexuality. But he also is just saying, like, hey, let's celebrate. And Bobby rightly brings the point. Shouldn't celebrate. We haven't gotten the money yet.
Yeah, and then there's our third member of the team, who is effectively the quote-unquote brains of the operation, in as much as there are brains for the operation. And that, yes, in this instance, is Alan Raimi, played by the great John Glover, who at this point is marching around with a video camera, issuing directions to the particular actors in the scene, we shall say, with an eye patch on, and is just sort of, again, gleefully hedonistic and enjoying himself as he's going through throughout the scene.
Yeah. Up until the part where Sini feeling regret over what she has done. She's having a bad time. And then at the end, we see Alan, at least, it's not, he acts out way worse, but then all of a sudden he flips from, like, excitable host to suddenly flipping out at her, which is a precursor of what's to come for Sini.
Yeah, but she's being basically covered at this point in time by, of all, in this instance, a character by the name of Doreen, played by Vanity, who we will soon discover is in a relationship of sorts with Bobby Shy. They at the very least seem to be living together, but she also works for, as we'll discover, for Leo Franks, who, as we discover, is operating an, let's just say, an adult parlor is the best way to put it.
The three of them seem loosely connected to, you know, the amorphous sphere that is adult entertainment. I don't think it's a film that's necessarily concerned with the specific how-to of what they're doing as much as it is just clearly demarcating them as sort of like guys from the underbelly.
Exactly. So at this point in time, as they basically they're getting a little bit nervous about Sini's actions and her sort of seeming regrets over this plan and regrets about being involved with any of them.
Yeah, because the weird thing is, Sini seems remorseful because she, it's implied that she develops actual feelings for Harry, whereas Harry is remorseful because he sees it as a dumb mistake that's going to jeopardize his wife's future. But I think it's important that neither of them are, like, gleeful in it.
Well, exactly. And you do get the sense that, yeah, I mean, as we will discover, he's not completely without feelings for Sini as well. But we'll get there in a moment. But the important thing is that, yes, at this point, the plan's still on rails. But there, we can obviously tell that there's tension between the trio of criminals out here that will become significant as the film goes on. But yes, this does lead us to, basically, the big district attorney fundraising campaign
dinner.
Yeah,
it's like a fundraiser reception. He gives the speech, but it's prefaced by Barbara introducing him by talking about what a man of character he is. It's the Harvey Dent in The Dark Knight thing.
Yeah.
And, like, it's so on the nose here, where it's just like, this is a man who would never tell a lie to a person he cares about. This is a man who knows one blind eye turned is one too many. This is a man who refuses to do wrong. This is a man that would never get blackmailed and jeopardize his wife's successes.
See, the thing that we're missing here is there's a shot that happens as she's sort of finishing up the speech and everybody's getting up and clapping. We get this great tracking shot of Sad Roy Scheider walking out of the hall, lighting up a cigarette and going out to the other thing. That needs to be a GIF somewhere.
Yeah. Online. But then he goes back and he looks at the stage, but through the glass door.
Yeah. Because, which, you know, might be symbolic of the barriers and the realizations of Harry's isolation from this community of noble individuals that happen to
it's
be
It's also a repurposing of the glass ceiling that Barbara is about to smash through.
There we go. But needless thinking of smashing things, they get home that night, and Harry decides that he is going to make a confession to her right off the bat.
To his credit, he does the Letterman, and he just comes right out with it.
Exactly. And we got to stop and pause on the scene, because while we may have questioned whether Anne Margaret was necessarily a star in the biggest sense before here, there is no doubt that she's a hell of an actor, as this scene proves.
Yeah. This is, like, both of them convey, like, this isn't a film where we're given a lot of backstory between Harry and Barbara, but so much is said and just delivered in this scene. It is one of the best parts of the entire movie.
Well, yeah, this is a scene where, in the wrong hands, in terms of writing, direction, and acting, this could be an over-the-top hysterics scene where people are yelling at each other at the top of their lungs and breaking down in tears and everything else, and that's not what we get. We just get, you know, Harry very sheepishly delivering the news to his wife. And Anne Margaret, basically, she's clearly angry, but she is in total control of that anger the whole time, as she very coldly starts laying out the facts and starts grilling him about, well, who was this? What's her name? That seems very cute. You know, what was it? Did you get to play daddy to her? Like, this, all these little things where, again, it's just, she's clearly hurt, she's clearly upset, But the fact that she's not coming right out and just screaming at it almost makes it worse. And you can just feel how she's needling Harry about his betrayal.
Harry, also to his credit, is fully honest, right? Yeah. Or at least we presume that he is. And, you know, he also, in describing how they met, he indicates that Sini was friends with this black girl, and seeing as Doreen is literally the only other one we see in the film, plants that seed. But he also tells her, like, Barbara, I didn't go looking. And, like, he emphasizes that, which is... It's interesting because the way that Scheider plays Harry through the scene, I think we are supposed to believe him. But that's sort of what Harry is stuck with for the film. The consequences of something he wishes he didn't do, and genuinely sees it as a mistake, but that's not enough to make it go away.
Well, yes, and I mean, Harry's basically leaves the house, effectively, at this point.
Yeah. And there's that great line where it's, how old is she? 22. You know, we have been married for 23 years. That's longer than she has been alive. And it's just like the way she delivers that, it cuts.
Oh, yeah. No, it is just like, again, a full props to her. And again, in a film where you wouldn't necessarily expect top tier acting, you're getting top tier acting in this movie, but without question.
It's also a film where you wouldn't expect women to be a strong voice of reason.
Yeah, although, as we'll see...
We will see, yes.
Yeah,
whether or not it's sustained.
Yeah.
So next up, it's the baseball scene where there's the presumed handoff of the first installment of the cash.
Yeah, and again, I love how this handles, because this is where Harry's supposed to do the big payoff. He's gone to these seats in the stadium, he's sitting where he's supposed to, and effectively, he is supposed to hand the money over to somebody who then delivers it to Bobby Shaye, who then makes his way out of the stadium to hook up with the other two and on their way back. And, of course, they do this. They check in the envelope. And Harry, in probably in the next very bad decision he chooses to make here, instead of giving him the money, leaves them a note basically telling them more or less to go screw themselves at this point in time. Which they don't take well to, needless to say. So,
well, and I mean, throughout this, you get the sense that the criminal trio is amateurish at best.
Yeah.
And, like, I didn't really know much about the plot of this film going in, and sort of one of the things that was most powerful to it is that it seems like it's almost going to be a comedy of errors with a bit of noir, where it's just... You know, sort of like a Fargo-type story.
Yeah.
But the thing is, when you get into it, like, Fargo is also a film where a number of people are murdered for literally no reason. And, you know, there's still that edge to it. Whereas you don't necessarily see that edge coming when you have John Glover calling everybody sport and flipping off other drivers and telling them to have a great day.
But let's get to the consequences of this, because we get two key scenes here. The first one is that when Harry's wife, Barbara, returns home after day work, she finds sitting in her house with the door open, there is Alan, basically claiming to be an accountant, wanting to help look into their finances.
And yeah, we satisfy or we eat the difference.
Exactly. And again, it's clearly an absurd claim, and John Glover, as he's playing it in this scene, it's like he knows what he's saying is absurd, but Alan just doesn't care. He can't help but...
Because Alan believes in it completely, even though he knows it's a lie.
Yeah.
And he knows that Barbara knows it's a lie, and she becomes increasingly agitated. And he's doing the, oh, well, everything I'm saying is totally reasonable. I knocked on the door. It was open. I just decided to sit. I figured someone was around. I'd like to talk to you about tax rates. And then finally she's like, give me your business card then. And then in one of those great John Glover villain moments, reaches into his pocket, smiles at her and says, oh, I don't have one. Don't worry. I'll be back.
Yeah, he leaves the house, and then as he gets back into where bit picked up along the line, and I think it's by Leo at this point, we find out the real reason he's there. Basically, he was gathering stuff of Harry's from the house, including a coat and what turns out to be a gun he happens to own there. Yes. So, okay, some big things. And next time we see Harry, who, you know, again, is feeling a little bit more confident for having not paid off these guys, because there could be no possible consequences for that, proceeds to be kidnapped by the trio again, thrown into this weird sort of abandoned room, forced by gunpoint to sit and watch another videotape that they've made. And again, this is where the film, which has already proven itself to be rather grim and sleazy at this point, goes to a whole nother realm.
Because
effectively, once again, we have Alan narrating this tape that he's made, where it's basically Cindy being put down into a chair.
She's drugged, she's undressed, and then she is shot 5 times in the chest with what we learn is Harry's gun. And then we see them planting evidence around the seed, and Harry realizes that, no, it's not just a trick, especially when he turns around and realizes he's sitting on a chair with 5 bullet holes and a massive blood stain on it.
Yeah, and they've got the coat, they've got the gun, they've got everything, and they're now demanding way more than they were the first time.
Yeah, so now it's $105,000 a year, every year, until they're all dead.
Yeah, so at this point, you know, and again, in one of the great follow-up scenes, we see Harry rush back to his house and start demanding of Barbara, was anybody here? Have you seen anybody in the last little bit? What has happened here? And basically, he starts it again. I love Roy Scheider when he plays absolutely broken, because at this point he is, it's like, oh man, I've screwed up. I've screwed up bad.
Because he thinks it's a bluff at first.
Yeah.
And even Alan admits as much, because like, it's almost like director commentary that he's offering, where he's just talking about like, yeah, so I actually set up 2 cameras here. I like the reverse shot. And then like, but then they're strapping down Cini, and he's like, she didn't think she could perform. But I mean, some people you have to tie down to convince they can act. And it's all just conversational. So we're almost as surprised as Harry when we slowly piece together, No, she actually was just murdered to prove a point.
Exactly. So with this, basically, Harry now has to turn, you know, is stuck with the fact that he has this massive situation on his hand. His marriage is on the rocks. He doesn't really know what to do. And it's a question of, well, how is he going to dig himself out of this hole? And basically, this is where the film sort of shifts gears, because ultimately, the way the film is going to play out is it becomes Harry more or less having to try and investigate and figure out who these 3 guys are.
Yeah, and I mean, it's like, we've looked at movies like Old Boy that sort of take the classic sort of investigative trope and invert that. And we have something sort of similar here by way of Straw Dogs.
Yeah, it's a little bit similar here, if less morally reprehensible than Straw Dogs is in many ways. That's a whole other film worthy of another conversation, but
I'm trying to figure out the order here of how he ends up getting to Leo's place.
Well, effectively, he starts looking for information, is asking even Barbara if somebody can look into something for her in order to, because basically he realizes
because Barbara's also offering to have Arvison, the DA, look into that, but then all of a sudden he's going to know, and then other people are going to know.
Yeah, and basically she talks about dropping out of the race, and he's like, no, don't do this. Give me a couple days. I can fix this. Because every decision Harry's made so far has worked out really grand.
Yeah, and even if he wanted to, though, he does not have $105,000 on hand, despite all of his wealth. The most he can muster up, How much do you want to guess it is, David?
Why, that would happen to be $52,000, as we'll eventually discover, which basically means...
Wow, that's a lot of money to pick up.
Ba-dum-dum. Yes, so if you're wondering, yeah, what this title was, or why there isn't card gambling in this movie, here's your reason for it. But yeah, I believe at this point, basically, his investigation starts by basically gathering some money together and trying to backtrace to Doreen, figuring that, well, it's through her that he met Cinny in the first place, and trying to track down where she works, which ultimately leads him to Leo Frank's place of business.
Yeah, and so here, I guess it's, they're offering, like, effectively private strip teases that the customer can photograph with a Polaroid.
Yes, it was the 80s, folks. Digital wasn't a thing yet, nor was the internet.
Yeah. Despite the strange business model, it does lead to that interesting standoff where Leo, very glad-handing, absolutely refuses to acknowledge that he knows who Harry is, despite Harry pressing, and Harry absolutely refusing to accept service from anyone other than Dion?
Doreen.
Doreen, that's the one. Which then leads to an exploitative, possibly exploitative, but interestingly staged scene where we get Roy Scheider in a chair, absently snapping photos with a Polaroid camera, as Vanity undresses while they interrogate one another.
And based on the money he's offering and that, they eventually decide that she could, would you like to go someplace else? In other words, her apartment, which we will later learn is, yes, the apartment she seems to share with Bobby Shy. And once they get there, basically Harry lays his cards out on the table, which is effectively that, look, I'm looking for information, I'm wanting to know about Cinny, and I'm looking for the names of the people who may have been involved. And basically, he starts offering money. It's like, well, you know, I can't really tell you because, you know, I don't know much. And even if I did, that could get me into trouble.
Yeah. And she's like, so I'll give you a hint so that way I can honestly tell people that I didn't tell you his name.
Yeah. And what she ends up giving him is Rainey at this point in time. And he's got to try and piece that together. So from there, again, I believe that's the information.
Oh, he also takes down the information from her paycheck from the from Leo's club. And then he ends up giving that to Barbara, who then gives it to the candidate to backtrace. And then they find Alan Raimi as somebody on their payroll. Because that's how he finds him at the theater.
Yes, and this leads to, yeah, he basically hunts him down to this theater that specializes in adult films. A grindhouse, if you will, even in the mid-1980s.
And, bumpin' grindhouse.
Yes, and when he goes upstairs to see the boss, Alan, up there, yeah, we get a very interesting thing where Alan basically is insistent, I don't know you, and he keeps saying, I've got money to give you. It's like, can I give it to you? Are you the guy? He goes, I don't know, am I? And they keep trading this back and forth, where finally, again, Harry finally puts him, it's like, I'm not sure you're the guy, but tell you what, how about you meet me here tonight over at this point, and maybe we can finally discuss this. And sure enough, Alan finally shows up at basically Harry's office after hours, where, and again, I love this scene.
Let's not skip past the fact that this is also sort of a turning point, because now that Harry confronts Alan, like, it's a reversal of the beginning, where Harry had no idea who Alan is, you know? He just walks into Cini's apartment, and there are these guys who have been blackmailing him, whereas now it's Harry showing up unannounced, and Alan, like, part of his dodging is his sociopathic nature, but there is an element in it, as Glover portrays it, where this is the first time he has actually been fearful, and that's because he is suddenly the target.
See, do you find it like that? Because I don't, that's not the sense I got while watching Glover's performance. I got the sense that Alan's almost, he's bemused by this whole thing. He's not really concerned, it's just someone's like, huh, Harry found me. Interesting. Okay, let's see where this goes. And the way the least Glover's performance plays to me is that he's enjoying this sort of count and mouse game. Like, he almost finds this, you know, like, fun to some degree, because he thinks he's a guy who's able to turn it around at a moment's notice for himself. as this
goes.
I don't know.
His panic, though, at various points through the film, I don't know if that bears out. But regardless, I think we can agree, though, that this, if nothing else, is sort of the hinge point of Harry rediscovering his male power.
Supposedly, yes. And this, yes, does lead to the scene where Alan arrives. And again, I love how he admires Harry's car on the outside. It's like, oh, this is amazing. The radio's kind of garbage, but, you know, otherwise, this is a very nice car. They trade these very barbed pleasantries before going up to Harry's office, and my God, John Glover, I love him. Basically, Harry tells him, like, here's the books. Why don't you take a look at them? And Alan reveals little bits and pieces of his backstory, which I think we can sort of assume are true, where it's like, no, I actually did go to college and learn about accounting. I know.
He's like, you know anything about business? Yeah, did a couple years at Northwestern. Business accounting. Just skimming through the ledgers. Receivables. Opens the other ledger. Keeps going. And what ultimately is revealed, though, is that Harry has found a way to get $105,000 out of his company, and that he is making a deal, notably with Alan.
Yeah.
To get it.
Yeah, exactly. And ultimately, as this basically begins the sort of Yojimbo plot, I guess is the best way to put it, where it is Harry ultimately working to try and pit the three different thugs against one another over this. And in this case, yeah.
Because when Alan asks how Harry was able to find him, he tells him that Leo identified him.
Exactly. Which leads to our follow-up scene where, and again, I love Frankenheimer's, you know, framing of the shots throughout the scene, because we've got basically a plane
with the bedroom scene.
Yeah, because you've basically got three planes of action where you've got Alan in the background, sort of midway between the two in terms of the framing. And it's clear he's sort of in the command. You've got Leo in the mid-ground, who's panicking like nobody's business. It's like, I didn't betray him. Why would I do this? Come on, guys. And he's clearly freaked out. And then you've just got Clarence William III's Bobby Shy up in the front, cleaning a gun. They're playing with it, just taking it all in. And ultimately, again, and I love the sort of dynamic where Alan's playing it like, oh, look, come on, this guy's got nothing on it. We just got to deal with him. We got to eliminate him there. And don't worry, Leo, it's fine. Don't worry. We're not going to take it out on you in this instance. But then they very quickly pin it's like
they rationalize that they have to, that if it was Doreen, though. Suddenly, Clarence Williams speaks. He says, Doreen wouldn't do that. She's a friend of mine. And she also knows that if she did, I'd throw her dead ass off a building. Which, I mean, it's a distinctive line and one way to break a silence. But at the same time, that's also kind of this film's attitude towards women.
Well, and this is the thing. We basically get the decision. It's like, we probably have to take out Harry at this point. And of course, Alan and Leo, despite being, you know, criminals here, yeah, you know, as far as their view, they're not necessarily killers offhand, so they're very quick to try and pin it on Bobby to go off and do
something.
They
just look over at Bobby as he clicks the slide into place, and he just looks up at them.
Yeah, and God, I love Clarence Williams in this movie.
They're like, you're the only one of us who's ever been to prison.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's just like, you get the feeling it's like, of all these ones, he's probably the only one who's actually a professional criminal in the degree, to the scale that anybody here is, and it's just like, why am I stuck with you two? But this...
So his plan is to break into Harry's place, which seems to go well until we get one of the few, like, fights in the movie, as Harry, with a little bit of help from Barbara, ends up besting our man Bobby, who is then tied to a chair and interrogated by Harry, who at least is gracious enough to give him a cocktail.
Exactly, and eventually plants the seeds that, yeah, I mean, I made a deal with Alan for all of you guys. Didn't he inform you about this? And it becomes very clear that he's setting up. Now, granted, I think this might be one of the moments where the writing's a little weak, where it feels like Bobby is too easy to buy into what Harry's selling him at this point. Because, again, he knows this guy's trying to get off the hook in many regards. Why would he just suddenly bind us? But...
Well, remember his line in the later scene where he says, I believe you, but then again, I believe everybody?
Yeah, which... it's partly a rationalized line, but also the way in which Williams plays it is just phenomenal. There's also around this, I can't remember whether it's immediately before or immediately after, we get Bobby going to visit Doreen in probably the most intense scene of the entire film.
Yeah.
Which is, okay, he walks into the apartment and basically it's like, hi, where are you? How's it going?
Yeah, it's very sing-song in that honey, I'm home tone.
Yeah.
And he maintains that tone for a while, even as his questions get more pointed and aggressive.
Yeah, and eventually when Doreen is sort of admitted, it's like, no, I didn't tell anybody anything. I didn't say anything. You know about that. You just see Clarence William, like, just the moment in his face where he's just sitting on a bed looking away from her. Then he picks up a pillow and it just like at the flip of a switch, he is on top of her, basically trying to choke her to death in an effort to get her to quote, basically admit what she's done. Yeah, here.
He half smothers her about three times in this scene before he finally accepts that she's telling the truth. The irony being that she's not.
Yeah, and it is just like he, again, I keep coming back to the intensity of his performance, but Williams is like just on another level of frightening in this scene. It is amazing to see the work he's turning in here. But anyways, yeah, so I mean, from this point, we've got the setup here for Leo and Alan and Bobby not to be trusting one another. And Leo Franks is just in an absolute panicked, messy state. Which at this point in time,
because he calls Harry to meet with him in a bar. And Leo does his sort of like, oh, what do you think of this joint? And like just doing the smarmy shtick for a bit.
Yeah.
But like while this time Harry barely has to say anything other than letting him know about the deal. We basically watch, and the camera frames largely in close-up on Robert Trevor's face, as, like, his grin gives way to fear, and he just keeps talking, and realizing how screwed he is, and realizing that they're probably gonna kill him, and then rationalizing how, Harry can go to the cops and he'll back him up. To which Harry, buys him another drink and then leaves.
Well, before that, we also find out the important details. It's like, well, where is the evidence?
Oh, right.
And Leo basically points out, it's like, well, the body was already disposed of. We didn't keep it, at this point. We didn't think we needed to. And basically, most of the evidence doesn't really exist at this point, because it was all part of this larger bluff that Alan was playing. And with
it's a larger bluff, but they actually killed a young girl when she was no longer useful to them.
Exactly.
But yes, so there actually isn't the incriminating evidence that they thought. Meanwhile, there's another meeting of the minds going down in Alan's bedroom.
Yeah.
As Bobby comes back, demands to know if they talked about a deal, and then proceeds to shoot the television, the mirrored ceiling, and pretty much anything made out of glass in the room.
I would just like to say, I mean, I don't even know whether these are still things out there, but the idea of a bedroom set where the bed has a mirror ceiling to it just fascinates me as a concept. Like, you know, that feels like one of those things, from a sheer safety perspective, I would never want that around me. Okay, folks? Yeah. As this film evidences.
Well, I wouldn't want an angry Bobby around me. As he puts it, if you're going to lie to me, you have to either be very stupid or very stoned. Which one are you?
Yeah, now Alan does manage to basically talk him more or less out of this by saying, it's like, look, we can get rid of, like you said, yes, I admit there's money, but we can get rid of Leo, thus confirming that everybody's suspicion that, yeah, Leo is effectively the least useful and therefore most expendable person in this entire situation. And that from that point forward, we can, split the money just between us at this point in time. So it's like, okay, there's a plan in place. And this is where I admit I'm trying to remember the exact order of how this plays out.
The scene where Leo gets killed in his office. Bobby comes to visit and does the menacing silent act and then leaves right when you think everything's going to be okay. He fires through the window, killing Leo and Leo's young acquaintance.
Yes. The ambiguous possible Leo's lover of some sort. It's strongly codified. We'll just say that in 1980s in all its less than glory. We'll put it that way.
I guess the next major event is while swimming in the pool, Barbara looks up to see Alan there, and in another wonderfully horrible Glover moment, he is holding a newspaper and is like, "Want to see something cool?" Flashes it down. He's holding a gun. He's, "Now you see it, now you don't. But now you know it's there. Let's go for a ride." And he keeps calling her Slim.
Yeah.
And it's very unsettling.
Well, it's just one of these things where I get the feeling, based on his entire dialogue, he was reading 1960s X-Men comics written by Stan Lee, where everybody's Slim or Sport or something throughout that. It's just like, no, I really identify with that Cyclops there. At this point...
So what ends up happening is Harry ends up going to Arvison, the DA. They basically tells him everything. He's like, "They've kidnapped my wife. I need to pay these guys. You've got to help me." So they make a deal to deliver the $52,000 on an abandoned bridge, the beach side.
Yeah, now we should point, it's not the DA, it's the his lawyer friend that he goes to for this.
Isn't it? Okay.
Yeah, but
they're both crusty old Hume Cronin looking men, so.
Yeah, but the important thing is, yeah, we at this point, Alan's got her doped up, but this leads to a sequence where Bobby and Doreen show up for what is supposed to be the drop-off here. She's just gonna drop off Bobby and then take off while they handle business, supposedly. And again, in a great shot, we got Bobby starting to walk up the stairs, and then Alan just puts a few slugs in him, taking him out. And then Doreen, who's unable to drive out because Alan's closed off this weird area, like parking garage almost type area.
I don't know how he has access to it, but somehow.
Exactly. But he then proceeds, as she tries desperately to drive her way out of there, finally puts a few slugs in her, killing her. And again, I love this shot of, after all this is done, Alan just walking up the stairway in this big panoramic shot behind him of the, you know, basically the deaths that lie behind him as he's making his way.
Yeah, and the car just slowly rolling.
Yeah, it is just glorious, which then leads to basically the scene. Now, or to the big trade-off scene, which will be our climax of the film. But what the big point here is...
Well, we're also skipping over the fact that there's an uncomfortably long sequence where Alan... Because it's not enough to simply tell us. We have to see the fact that he takes Barbara to a hotel room where she is restrained. He injects her with heroin. And then he takes his shirt off and sexually assaults her. We don't see the sexual assault, but with where it ends and the fact that he subsequently boasts about it.
Yeah.
Like, Dave, they make it clear that it's not just he kidnaps Barbara, but he kidnaps her and rapes her.
Yeah, no, it is. And this is probably the point where the film goes most over the line. I mean, it's the touch of evil treatment that Janet Leigh gets in that film there in this repurposed here. And I don't know whether this was an intended homage on the part of either Leonard or Frankenheimer, but it does play out like it in this instance. And unfortunately so, because it is a detail that could easily have been left out of the film at the and not consequently changed anything that happens.
Well, it's one of those things where it's like, I think we've already established Alan is a scumbag. They even find out, like, the lawyer's like, "You should have told me about this when you had the chance," because there is that incidental mention of he did years in juvenile hall for bludgeoning his stepfather to death and was convicted of rape twice.
Yeah. But the important thing is there's the phone call from Alan to Harry where he points out to him that, look, come here. And Harry basically says, look, fine, I've got the money, I'll get it to you, I'll even throw in my car. And let me bring up the car here for a second, because I think this is probably one of the most clever use elements of this movie, is how the car is utilized throughout this film as sort of a symbol and motif. Because you've got this thing where, again, if the best way to describe Harry and every decision he makes here is really terrible handling of a midlife crisis, where it's that feeling of, I want to be young and youthful and vibrant again.
Yeah, because they also make it a point that a 68 Jaguar, he restored himself.
Yeah, and everything about that car is that, I mean, it is very much that, you know, I am a potent strong man. Like, you know, this is my status symbol of, you know, how big I am and how powerful I am. Metaphorically, not necessarily literally, folks. I'll leave your mind to describe that. But the big thing here is that, yeah, it's very much this, yeah, big status symbol that, and again, you always get this feeling that whenever Barbara sees him working on the car, she's not pleased with it. There's something about her not liking that car.
Well, even as they're getting blackmailed, you know, Harry's just calmly fixing the car, working on the spark plugs, and she's like, how can you be doing that at a time like this? And I mean, that's a scene that's like midway through the movie. So, I mean, there's definitely something to the fact that when his car is at its nicest, that Harry is at his most dispossessed. Which takes us to this final scene.
Because, yeah, he offers to, yeah, toss in this car, and yeah, we get to this bridge. And again, if you want to think through the logic of the staging of this scene, it doesn't make a lot of sense for a couple reasons.
It makes sense for the camera, but not for diegetic reality.
Yeah, like, I don't know, like, this bridge doesn't appear to be cut off. It's not under construction. I don't know why they're the only ones there, particularly in a city like Los Angeles.
If it is under construction, then how did they both get in there?
Exactly. It's a very questionable staging. But Harry shows up, the bridge comes down, which connects it so that the two men can make the trade-off. And sure enough, Harry walks over, hands over the briefcase. Again, Alan makes his way over to the car and allows Harry to go with his wife. And of course, again, we had that scene earlier where Alan was admiring the car and making the cracks about the audio system. And sure enough, he goes in, turns on the car, turns on the radio, and okay, this is the moment where I haven't read the novel.
This is the moment where I looked at my TV and said, what?
Yeah, because this is like, I strongly suspect that at least one part of this scene was not in the original Elmore Leonard novel, and that this was deliberately created for the film.
Or rather, I feel like this is the scene that most heavily feels like a canon film.
Yeah, because effectively what happens here is we get the Death Wish scene in this thing, where Alan turns on the radio, and then it turns on that there's a tape that Harry has apparently mocked up that plays this sort of marching music.
Like opera music, or yeah, like big band music, while all the doors automatically lock themselves, and like the door handles fall off from the inside, and the windows all roll up, while Harry basically taunts him via audio cassette.
Yeah, now again, if this were a film set now with a somewhat semi-computerized car with a dashboard like that, I might be able to buy into some of this. Okay, a contemporary BMW? Sure. Why not? There are computers there. I don't think cassette tape technology in the 1980s in a 1968 muscle car really was capable of doing anything that's happening in this scene, okay?
Yeah, it kind of feels like reading, like, a Ray Bradbury story from the 1950s. I'm thinking about the one about the automatic coffin, where it's like, well, it's good to have an imagination. This is also a film, though, that is, right up until this point, everything has been so hard-edged and so noirish and so brutal and ugly that all of a sudden we have a magic exploding car.
Well, and that's, you see, here's the thing, yeah.
They may as well have just stamped Deus Ex Machina over this whole scene and then just rolled credits.
See, the thing is I can at least say this. I can accept the car exploding because they at least set up that Harry has access two explosives early on in the film.
They do introduce all of the threads that are involved. I just don't know if it's the tapestry that works best for the film.
It is. It's over the top. And again, I would be fine with it if it was just, you know, Alan turns on the car and it explodes because, hey, guess what? He's rigged it with a bomb using the explosive he has. That would be one thing. Over the top, but still believable. Everything with the tape leading up to the explosion in this, like, basically he's giving Alan a few minutes to get out of this vehicle, like smashing a window or something. Like, I mean, if I were Alan, I'd be like taking...
Yeah, and the car explodes as Alan draws the gun and is about to fire. And it's like, okay, did we really need the previous 9 seconds of letting him know that you've won?
Yeah, it's just, it's like, yeah, I mean, Harry, I get it. This is your big quote-unquote hero moment, but yeah, I'm not buying it, sir. But this...
And it's literally the end of the film, because him and Barbara walk off, and in that wonderful, like... you know, slowly backtracking shot, we see them embrace on the bridge, but then literally the credits roll.
Yeah, and I mean, with fairness to it, I don't think we really need any more.
I'm like, where do you go from there? You know, it's sort of like the ending of Violent Cop or some of the more dour Kitano films.
Well, and it's one of those things also when looking at it, I mean, the big quote-unquote reconciliation between Harry and Barbara happens prior to her kidnapping as well, because we get that moment, I think it's right after the Bobby Shea home invasion scene, where she just...
The big hug.
Yeah. Where, and again, it's a moment where I don't think the film really entirely earns that moment then, which means that really these final moments, I don't think they're intended to play ambiguously, but they might as well play a bit more ambiguously because of it at this point, in terms of what the actual dynamic for Harry and her going forward are, because yeah, the kidnappers are dead. I don't think you're saving this relationship. And I'm sure as heck thinking that there's probably a better than average chance that some reporters are going to find out about the fact that you just got drugged and kidnapped by pornographers here. And
maybe,
yeah,
just maybe. I think the other piece, though, is that this is a film made by men, clearly in response to some sort of male panic. Because, I mean, like, especially the stuff with the car and, like, the fact that the happy ending is, as you said, the car being blown up, like, letting that go and sort of finding matrimony is the happy ending. It's like, well... This is also a film from 34 years ago. Like, I don't know if we're supposed to read it a certain way, because I'm not John Frankenheimer in the 80s, right? So, regardless of what they were trying to do, that's one thing, but I'm, like, not even sure if we can take that at face value.
Well, exactly. I mean, it's a bit of an ambiguous but not on purpose ending that you're sort of left with, where you got to kind of parse it out.
And I think actually, David, that may be a good point to segue to, I think, the bigger question, because we've talked about, like, a lot of things we've enjoyed thus far, and we got to wrap this one fairly soon. But I think the bigger outspoken question is sort of the searcher's dilemma, right? Is this a film that's misogynistic, or is it just a film about deeply misogynistic men?
And here's my thing. I am willing to give this film more of the benefit of the doubt than I am typically, mostly because, and I think, again, in comparison to the film we discussed last week, Gotti, a movie that has no understanding as to what a reprehensible human being John Gotti was, this is a film that right from the outset is at least telling you that your main character is a scumbag in many regards. He is a screw-up. And the people who pay the price for his mistakes are the women in his life. And it's not like there are any good men in this film. Like, it's not like we're supposed to suddenly look at Harry and say, well, he was, you know, he was just being a guy. Like, there's no try to.
Well, I don't know. He's our point of identification, though. And do you think by having, especially Alan, get so cartoonishly evil in his moral reprehensibility, do you think in some way that almost, whether intended or not, like, doesn't that almost have the effect of being like, well, he only had a fling with a 22-year-old, you know? That's not nearly as bad as murdering Kelly Preston.
But it's also a film that doesn't wash Harry's hands of his responsibility in the consequences of those actions.
True.
Because
I mean, it's a film where the whole narrative is Harry facing the consequences of what he thought was inconsequential.
Exactly. And I mean, it's the big thing where it's like, okay, if this had been Harry, if the film had been Harry screws up and things escalate without him making further mistakes, that'd be one thing. I think the fact that he doesn't do the payoff at the start of the film, or he doesn't accept the consequences of going to law enforcement in the first place, that's where it's like, it doubles down on the fact that Harry makes bad decisions, and then he makes even worse decisions out of a sense of ego, and that he's, you know, it's like, no, I'm a man. I can stand up to these people. And it's like, whoa, really? That's what you think you are? watch what happens. And again, it's one of those things where I think that you're right. Alan definitely is a much more cartoonishly villainish figure. And in some ways,
I think it's also tempered, though, by the fact that Barbara, despite the way that she's treated at the level of plot, I mean, she is definitely a character, like, she's not Skyler on Breaking Bad, where her goodness comes with sort of being an overbearing shrew.
Well, there's part of that, and I think it definitely, again, to come back to the potential allusions to Touch of Evil there, she's a much stronger character than Janet Leigh is in that film there. So it's not like she's just a victim out and out. Like, she is, in terms of her marriage, she is in full control of that situation the whole time through. The fact that she finds herself in over her head dealing with these reprehensible, violent characters, I mean, it's not like a case where it's out of the, it's unexpected that she would be, she's not being punished, let's put it that way, for sins that she makes.
I also like that early moment of sort of like reconciliation, where Harry ends up just straight up asking her, can I please sleep here tonight? And she just looks at him and says, you can make up the den. And, like, I like that, where it's like, I'm not forgiving you, but, I mean, as she says, they've been married for 23 years, and that means something. And, you know, I think it's interesting that she's a character that has that space to be complex. But, I mean, at the same time, you can't necessarily brush aside the fact that there are some downright misogynistic moments depicted in the film.
Well, yeah, and that's where it gets a little tricky, because on one hand, it does ask that question of whether the film is reveling in it, which, given that this is a Golden Globus film, I'm not putting it past them, because, look, and it's the thing, I've said it before and I'll say it again, Death Wish 2, the one that is one of the most reprehensible movies I have ever seen. Like, it is an out-and-out immoral, vile film on any level you'd think about it. Great soundtrack, but horrific movie. But so it's one of those things where I'm willing to bet that some of these elements were probably pushed closer to the forefront to appease Menahem Golan and Globus as well.
I mean, like, casting someone as attractive as Kelly Preston in 1986, you want your movie to get made? Well, you tell him, yeah, she's going to take her top off. All right, let's green light this.
Yeah, and I feel, and again, I mean, Kelly Preston, I feel bad for her here, because she, Cinny is a nothing role, because, it, again, speaking this, I mean, she basically,
hey, Dave, let's do our hits and pits, but do it backwards.
Well, so, do we want to jump into that then?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think we're pretty much at the end of it, so we may as well summarize, and what better way than with our patent-pending bumper segment, Hits and Pits, where we celebrate and condemn the little things.
Yes.
So, let's start on a positive note, because as grim as this film is, I did find myself enjoying it, as a well-made, if not necessarily pleasant, film. So, Dave.
Yes.
You're also an even more positive person than me. What is your first hit for 52 Pickup?
I'm actually going to give it to the trio of Glover, Trebor, and Williams III, because
you can't give it to three. Okay.
Yeah. All right. Hey, it's our show. We can make up the dang rules as we make it. But I think because they play off of each other so well throughout this film, it feels wrong to sort of highlight one without the other, because they are all playing their characters to the hilt. And again, it's, I don't know whether they were probably discussing things between them as they were coming on set. It's like, well, if I did this, you could do this. Or if I, you know, if I'm going to play it this way, what if you were to try this? But it feels like all three are in perfect sync with one another.
Well, yeah, there's something theatrical, not just in the sense that they're all kind of eccentric, but like in that bedroom scene, there's a sense of almost theater-like spatial location and sort of placement in depth.
Well, exactly. So, I mean, I think on that level, like more so than even, Schreider and Margaret, like, this feels very much like films divided into two different spheres and spaces, because we've got the, the Anne-Margaret stuff there with Harry, and then we've got Harry with the criminals themselves, and those two worlds, they intersect at points, but they very much are their own sort of contained spheres for large portions of the movie. And getting to see them play off of it, and again, like, this is not a case where so often, you know, I think there's a tendency when they think about, particularly now, when it comes to writing criminals, characters, or villains, as it were, you know, you want to make the villains, there's that idea, there's someone sympathetic, or at least they have understandable goals, which, you know, you can sympathize with. This film has no interest in sympathizing with any of these three guys. Yeah. Like, they are.
And I mean, it's not even clear why they want or need this money. Like, Harry wasn't the target of a long-term op. It was just a thing that happened.
Yeah.
It's like Punch Drunk Love, where it's just like, oh, that got out of hand.
Well, exactly. Like, you get the feeling that this was purely a crime of opportunity. It's like, well, why not do this? Why not take advantage of this fairly well-to-do sucker now that we've got something on him? And yeah, I mean, again, they are not brilliant criminals, but they are absolute slime balls from start to finish. Even Trebor, even though he's probably the most quote-unquote sympathetic, at the end of the day, he's pitiful and just pathetic in so many ways. And it's like, you want to feel sorry for him only in the sense that it's like, you were way too dumb to be even have even thought of getting into this situation here.
Exactly. This is what a master criminal looks like.
Exactly. So I think for that level there, I mean, I have to give it to those three. And again, I mean, I almost, again, the way they eat dialogue in this movie, they are just like, they get some of the choice stuff here to play.
Well, yeah. And I mean, it allows them to be quirky. And I mean, that's probably an opportune moment to say my first hit, which is the script, which written by Elmore Leonard with John Stepling. It definitely feels like Elmore Leonard is writing the dialogue, but when you see it on screen and you hear it performed, especially by capable actors, like, there's a snappiness to it and a humor to it that just, like, it's far more clever than you would think, and far more quotable than you would think as well. Despite the silliness of the end, I think it's a remarkably sharp script. So I'm going to give that my first nod.
Yeah, and I would probably suspect that a lot of that ending, again, with the keeping in mind that I haven't read the source material, I imagine John Stepling probably created the bulk of that.
Well, I don't know. Get Shorty also is a narrative that's crisis is resolved by a loose board on a deck, right? So, I mean, it's not really about the plot so much as the experience of being in this world at times.
Yeah, no, absolutely. For my second hit, though, I gotta give it to Yas Makano, the cinematographer on this film, who, again, this film comes out in 1986, and within a year of this, he would go on to shoot Paul Verhoeven's RoboCop as well, and prior to this, shot Das Boot. Again, we're talking about a guy who was a heavy hitter already by this point, working with a heavy-hitting director, and you can tell in terms of the composition, camera movement, and lighting throughout this film. There is that one, like, again, there's this that beautiful 80s grit that very, I wish.
Yeah, this feels like a grimier version of Manhunter. And I mean that as a compliment.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, it's not quite as, you know, it doesn't quite have the sleaze factor of, say, Abel Ferrara's Fear City. Arguably the film that's closest to this. But it's a little too more polished than that. But this still feels lived in. And again, even though it's mostly naturalistic in terms of our lighting sources, for the most part, it never gets theatrical necessarily here. But again, though, when you get scenes like, again, the scene in Harry's office between him and Alan as Alan's looking over the books, and the most of the lighting is just coming from the desk lamp that happens to be there on John Glover's face as the light's reflecting off of his glasses and he's just flipping through these red-covered ledger books is just, again, there are some striking visuals throughout this film. And again, it's kind of a shame not to be able to see this on the big screen necessarily, but I would say if you're able to get your hand on the Kino Lorber Blu-ray, this is a film well worth investing in it, because there's not a lot on it, but it looks good.
Yeah, I was fortunate enough to see a Blu-ray copy of it, and yeah, this for such an ugly film, they make it look very appealing. There's sort of that hypnotic quality to it. But I think that is something that's certainly assisted, though, by my second hit, the score by Gary Chang. It's an incredibly 80s synth score, yeah, but in the best way possible, where it underscores the visuals perfectly. It's got that almost Vangelis Blade Runner, like Alien Sax kind of feel to it at times. But no, it, even just from frame one, it felt so good to listen to this movie.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this was the film that kicked off Gary Chang's long collaboration with John Frankenheimer for the latter part of Frankenheimer's career, because they would go on to do The Island of Dr. Monroe together and amongst a few other John Frankenheimer films. But on top of that, he would also go on to, you know, I hate to say it, but Gary Chang sort of got the raw deal of effectively scoring some of the lower tier B-level or C-level action films of the 90s and into the 2000s with things like The Substitute starring Tom Berenger.
Yeah, The Substitute.
Yeah, or Double Team, the Jean-Claude Van Damme film, or David Goyer's, I believe his very first produced screenplay, Death Warrant, starring Jean-Claude Van Damme as well. So wow. Gary Chang cornered the market on Van Damme, at least for a little bit.
May we all be so lucky. So other than latent misogyny and excessive depictions of violence against women, what are your pits for this film? I mean, I would say Kelly Preston, but that's not necessarily her fault. More so, the pit is the fact that you have talented actresses in the form of Ms. Preston and Vanity without really having anything for them to do.
Yeah, I would say probably my big hits, there's a couple parts, I know you just praised the script, and for the most part, I'm with you, but there are a couple points where it misses the mark, and I think, A, the reunion between Harry and Barbara, I get that they just had that scary experience with Bobby Shaw in their home, but it feels a little unearned by that point for her to be that forgiving of Harry for his screw-ups at that point in time.
Well, if she is, it's kind of like, because you proved yourself the alpha, you fought off that scary man in our home.
Well, precisely.
And if that's why she's forgiving, then maybe this film's a bit more regressive than we thought.
Well, exactly. There is some uncomfortably loaded elements to that scene. Likewise, again, there's just little things like the way in which Bobby... I know he gets that dialogue about how that I believe everybody moment there. It still feels like that's a scene where Clarence Williams is really trying to make a bit that he knows doesn't work in the script, work on screen. And God bless him, he's trying his heart out to make it fly. And he almost makes it. He almost does. But I think another pass at that scene and a little bit more dialogue and some more heavy lifting for convincing Ra on the part of Harry would have tightened that up a bit and made it more cohesive. But though that's more of a minor nitpick, I would say, than a deal breaker for me. What about you? Anything more substantial in terms of a pit?
No, I don't think so. I mean, other than the fact this film is 2 hours and like tonally, it is pretty much after the first 5 minutes, that same consistent tone. So, I mean, I'm not going to pretend it's a film that's easy watching or a film that's for everybody. So, know what you're getting into, because it does feel like a bit of a grind.
Well, then that's the thing. Yeah, if you're expecting the quirkier Elmore Leonard adaptations of the 90s, yeah, you're not going to get that. But on the other hand, it is massively better than The Big Bounce starring Owen Wilson. So, I mean, let's... be thankful for small favors, at least when in this instance.
Exactly. And Dave, why don't you do us all a small favor and tell us where we're going to be going next episode?
Well, here's the funny thing. We're actually, Clarence Williams III is somebody we've been praising like nobody's business. And there are many places we could have followed him, including Tales from the Hood, which I was very tempted to select.
And when you brought it up, I was kind of hoping you would.
But no. Instead, I feel like, you know what we haven't looked at in a while, Andrew? A film that is ostensibly a biopic, more or less, kind of, if you squint at it. And, you know...
We did Talk to Me. Does that count?
We also did Gotti, which sort of counts. But no. We're going to talk about something that's a little more... not quite the true story, but is so closer to something like JoJo Dancer, where it's very much influenced by reality, but the names have all been changed, even if the major principle...
Get rich or die trying.
Yeah. In this instance, what we have here, we're going to follow Clarence Williams III to the film Purple Rain, starring the one...
which I have never actually seen. And as a child of the 80s, I feel like a fraud. So, yes, one more off the bucket list.
Yeah, so a film inspired by Prince's relationship with Vanity, who is not in the movie, for reasons we'll get into when we take a look at that. So, yeah, more technical connections in this instance. But, yes, get ready for an amazing soundtrack, some stellar sequences, and, yeah, more misogyny. It can't all be pretty rainbows here.
That's the movie where they play Party Man, right?
I don't remember Party Man. It's not in that one. That was, in fact, actually...
No, Dave, it's in Batman. That's the
yeah, question. I know. That was my point. Oh, yeah, sorry. Okay. I was yeah.
No, I'm not... Yeah. I'm dumb, but I'm not that dumb. And you would have to be dumb to go another week without reaching out to us on social media. Dave, where can people get in touch with you?
Well, you can find me at 24Panels. I'm probably mostly there in the evenings these days, so please, if I don't respond to you immediately, don't take offense, folks. But what about you, Angel? Let's just say somebody wants to talk to you. Where can they reach you?
You can reach me maybe at FilmStripper on Twitter. I have two children. I am a busy man, so why don't you leave us some long-form correspondence and email us at our show, filmstripspodcast@gmail.com. And as always, you can rate and review us in iTunes or whatever podcasting service you use. Helps move us up the promoted list, and another way to leave some feedback. What works for you and what doesn't? Every single week, all Dave and I try to do is bring you a show you want to listen to.
Absolutely. So, with that, Andrew, do you happen to have any parting words for our listeners at home?
Why, yes, David, I do. Remember, everyone, adventure may scare you, but monotony will kill you.
They'll also put it on tape and use it to blackmail your loved ones. Bye.